The eldest man is 70 years old.
As an Israeli attack in Gaza Sunday killed dozens of members of a displaced family who were reportedly asleep when their home was targeted, Qatar has suspended efforts to mediate a Gaza ceasefire. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia is hosting dozens of world leaders for an Arab-Islamic summit to deal with Israeli aggression. We'll go to The Hague to speak with Dutch-Palestinian Middle East analyst Moin Rabbani and also get an update on the protests in Amsterdam. Then more than 2,000 people packed the historic Riverside Church in New York City Sunday for a discussion about America and the war on Palestine, moderated by author Ta-Nehisi Coates.
This was also the place where Martin Luther King stood up against the Vietnam War and was so courageous. And I want to acknowledge that in his time when he did that, a lot of people did not applaud.
We'll also hear Palestinian human rights professor Noor Erekat, author of Justice for Some. But first, we look at racist text messages telling people to report to the closest plantation sent to black people across the country by name, starting the day after Trump's election victory.
We remember what the climate in the country was like from 2016 to 2020. And so it appears that it's returning to that type of climate. Very disappointing that individuals would target African Americans with such hateful comments and commentary.
We'll speak with NAACP's Wisdom Cole and Professor Robert Green II. He teaches at Claflin University, the oldest and first historically black university in South Carolina, and president of African American Intellectual History Society. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. President-elect Donald Trump has picked Thomas Homan to serve as his so-called border czar. Homan served as acting director of ICE, that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement, during the first Trump administration. He's backed Trump's plans to deport as many as 20 million immigrants. During a recent interview on 60 Minutes, Homan said the mass deportation campaign could also target U.S.-born children who were born to undocumented parents. He was interviewed by Cecilia Vega.
We have seen one estimate that says it would cost $88 billion to deport a million people a year.
I don't know if that's accurate or not.
Is that what American taxpayers should expect?
What price do you put on national security? Is that worth it?
Is there a way to carry out mass deportation without separating families?
Of course there is. Families can be deported together.
That interview on CBS's 60 Minutes. The appointment of Tom Homan comes as the Wall Street Journal reports advisors to Trump are considering using military bases to hold detained immigrants and military planes to carry out deportations. In other transition news, CNN's reporting Trump has offered Republican Congresswoman Elise Stefanik the job of U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Meanwhile, Trump has ruled out jobs in his new administration for former CIA Director Mike Pompeo and former U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley. In other election news, the Associated Press has projected Donald Trump has won the state of Arizona, giving him a clean sweep of the seven battleground states. With Arizona, Trump is projected to have won a total of 312 electoral votes. Kamala Harris has won 226. In other news from Arizona, Decision Desk is now projecting Democrat Ruben Gallego has beaten Republican Carrie Lake to fill Senator Kyrsten Sinema's seat. Meanwhile, in Nevada, Democratic Senator Jackie Rosen has won re-election, defeating Republican Sam Brown. Overall, Republicans have won control of the Senate and will soon pick a new majority leader. Three senators are in the running: Senator John Thune of South Dakota, Senator John Cornyn of Texas, known as the Johns, and Senator Rick Scott of Florida. On Sunday, Trump said the next majority leader must embrace recess appointments to make it easier for him to quickly fill posts without Senate oversight. For years, both Republicans and Democrats have opposed this move. Sources close to liberal Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor says she has no intention to resign. Some Democrats have privately pushed the 70-year-old justice to step down to give President Biden a chance to nominate a successor before Trump takes office on January 20th. Meanwhile, a coalition of groups have announced plans to hold a People's March on Washington on January 18th, 2 days before Trump's inauguration. Protest organizers include Planned Parenthood, the ACLU, and the Women's March. The FBI is investigating a spate of racist text messages targeting Black Americans in the wake of Trump's election victory. The text messages were reported in states including Alabama, Missouri, the Carolinas, Michigan, Texas, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Virginia, telling recipients they were, quote, selected to pick cotton at the nearest plantation, unquote. The NAACP condemned the messages, warning Trump's election has emboldened hate groups. People as young as 13 years old were sent these messages by name. We'll have more on this story after headlines. Israel carried out deadly strikes on Gaza, Lebanon, and Syria over the weekend, while the United States bombed Yemen over the past 2 nights. This comes as Saudi Arabia is hosting dozens of world leaders for an Arab Islamic summit in Riyadh to discuss Israeli aggression in the region. In Gaza, Israel struck a family home in the Jabalia refugee camp early Sunday, killing 36 Palestinians, including at least 13 children and 9 women. Relatives of the family decried the attack.
The home of Abu Sobe al-Alush was crowded with residents and not affiliated with any organization. They are simply people trying to make a living, minding their own business, and have no involvement with anyone. This strike targeted civilians who have no ties to any groups or organizations. More than 50 people were there, as their grandchildren, children, and daughters, all displaced, had taken refuge with them, seeking safety. The house was struck while they were all inside.
Later in the broadcast, we'll hear from Palestinian-American human rights professor Nora Erekat, who'll talk about the attack on Jabalia. Israel's killed at least 4 more Palestinian journalists in Gaza. Mohammed Khreis and his wife died in an airstrike on their tent near the Nuseirat refugee camp. Ahmad and Zahra Abu Sahel were killed in an Israeli airstrike targeting a school in Al-Tufa. The radio broadcaster Khaled Abu Zir was killed on Friday. This comes as the UN-backed Famine Review Committee has issued a dire warning saying there's a, quote, strong likelihood that famine is imminent in areas of northern Gaza. In other news, Qatar has withdrawn from its role as mediator between Israel and Hamas. Israel's also continuing its assault on Lebanon despite Israeli claims ceasefire talks are progressing. On Saturday, Israeli strikes killed 20 people in and around the ancient city of Baalbek. On Sunday, an Israeli strike on the village of Almat north of Beirut killed 23 people, including at least 3 children. Israel also targeted numerous villages in the West Baqa region.
This is my house. I worked so hard my whole life to build it. No one helped me. I did it all by myself through hard work to raise my family composed of 7 to 8 souls, and I'm still working actively. I found it all destroyed. I don't have in it any missiles to attack the Israelis. The enemy is a butcher with no pity nor mercy at all, even for children. We've been resistant since our childhood until the end of our lives.
Lebanese state media reports at least 10 paramedics were also killed over the weekend as Israel continues to target Lebanon's health workers. Over the weekend, Russia and Ukraine launched major drone attacks against each other. Russia reportedly fired 145 drones, while Ukraine attacked Moscow with more than 30 drones. Russian attacks overnight killed 6 in southern Ukraine. Meanwhile, U.S. and Ukrainian officials say 50,000 Russian and North Korean troops are planning to launch a counteroffensive in western Russia to regain land seized by Ukraine. This all comes as the Washington Post reports Donald Trump spoke on Thursday with Russian President Vladimir Putin and urged him not to escalate the war in Ukraine. The Kremlin has denied the report. The UN climate summit is underway in Baku, Azerbaijan, where government officials, civil society leaders, and climate activists are gathered as the planet is on track yet again to suffer its hottest year on record, and carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere reach record highs. Recent data shows wealthy countries, including the U.S. and China, embarked on an oil and gas exploration spree, despite signing on to an agreement at last year's COP to transition away from coal, oil, and gas. Financing for poor nations facing the brunt of the climate collapse will be a top issue at this year's COP29. Ahead of the summit, the group Global Witness released covert recordings of Azerbaijan's COP29 chief executive, Elnor Sultanov, promoting possible fossil fuel deals with someone posing as an investor. The fake investor told Sultanov they were considering sponsoring COP29 in exchange for deals with Azerbaijan's state energy firm, SOCAR. This is Sultanov.
As I said, we have a lot of pipeline infrastructure. We have a lot of gas fields that are to be developed. We have a lot of green projects that SOCAR is very interested in. There are a lot of joint ventures that could be established, potential joint ventures. Our SOCAR trading is trading oil and gas all over the world, including in Asia. So to me, these are the possibilities to explore.
Meanwhile, many delegates at COP29 are bracing for the incoming Trump presidency. Trump's transition team is reportedly already preparing to once again withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Climate Agreement. Prominent climate activist Greta Thunberg announced she is not attending COP29 over Azerbaijan's climate and human rights record. She's calling for protests tonight in Tbilisi, Georgia, where she's been meeting with local activists. She wrote on social media, quote, "Azerbaijan, using COP29 as a facade, is ramping up control under a false green agenda, tightening its grip on power and escalating regional tensions," unquote. Democracy Now! Will be reporting live from COP29 in Baku, Azerbaijan, all next week from November 18th to the 22nd. Tune in to democracynow.org. In Amsterdam, police beat and arrested more than 100 pro-Palestinian protesters Sunday after they defied a ban on demonstrations following street clashes between visiting Israeli soccer fans and Dutch youth. Unrest in the city began Wednesday when fans of the Maccabi Tel Aviv football team were seen chanting pro-genocide, anti-Arab slogans and tearing down Palestinian flags. Street clashes broke out as tensions escalated before and after the soccer match. Amsterdam's mayor blamed, quote, anti-Semitic hit-and-run squads, but observers in Amsterdam said Israeli hooligans instigated the violence. The violence grew into an international story as Israel sent planes to evacuate the Israeli fans. Haiti's Transitional Council announced its ousting interim Prime Minister Gary Conille after 6 months in the position, a move labeled by Conille as illegal and which is likely to further destabilize Haiti. The former UN official had been expected to see Haiti through its long-awaited election for a new president. The council named businessman Alex Didier Fils-Aimé as the new interim Prime Minister. Fils-Aimé is a businessman, former Senate candidate, and son of the prominent Haitian activist Alex Fils-Aimé. The political shakeup comes amidst worsening gang violence and a dire humanitarian crisis in Haiti. On Friday, the UN warned famine spreading to new areas as an international Kenyan-led security force struggles to contain the bloodshed. In Pakistan, a bomb blast killed at least 26 people Saturday at a railway station in Quetta, the capital of Balochistan province. The separatist group Balochistan Liberation Army claimed responsibility for the attack. And in other news from Pakistan, thousands of supporters of jailed former Prime Minister Imran Khan rallied over the weekend to call for his release. Khan's supporters have been protesting his imprisonment on what they say are politically motivated charges, as well as the disputed results of February's elections. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show looking at this spate of racist text messages referencing slavery that were sent to black people across the United States starting the day after Donald Trump's election victory. People in New York, in Alabama, in California, Georgia, Illinois, Indiana, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, and Virginia including students at historically black universities and even middle schoolers as young as 13 years old, reported getting a variation of this message that was addressed to them by name. Quote, "Greetings, William Hines. You have been selected to pick cotton at the nearest plantation. Please be ready November 7th, 2024, by 5 p.m. sharp with your belongings. Our executive slaves will come to your address in a black SUV. Be prepared to be searched down once you've entered." A similar text message sent to a man in Charlotte, Virginia, read, quote, "Greetings, Samuel. You've been selected to pick cotton at the nearest plantation. Be ready at 12 p.m. sharp with your belongings. Our executive slaves will come get you in a brown van. Be prepared to be searched down once you've entered the plantation. You are in Plantation Group W." Monet Miller described her reaction when she received the racist text message.
I immediately texted it the number back. Who is this? Oh, my God, profanity. And then I even tried to call it. And that's when I found out it was, like, from a fake text, one of those fake numbers. So it had already been discarded.
The FBI and FCC, that's the Federal Communications Commission, say they're now investigating the racist text messages, and the source remains clear. A Trump campaign remains unclear. They just know it comes from text now. A Trump campaign spokesman said it, quote, has absolutely nothing to do with these text messages. This is Georgia's NAACP president, Gerald Griggs.
Our response is to remind the young people where they come from, who they are, and that we do not sit back and allow people to threaten us without a response, a nonviolent, peaceful response, but a forceful response that this is our country. We're not returning to any plantation. We built this country. We'll continue to make this country move forward and live up to the promise that it gave all the citizens.
Meanwhile, Fisk University, the historically black college in Nashville, Tennessee, issued a statement calling the messages that targeted some of its students deeply unsettling. For more, we're joined by two guests. In Washington, D.C., Wisdom Cole is with us, Senior National Director of Advocacy for the NAACP. And in Columbia, South Carolina, Robert Green II, history professor at Claflin University, president of the African American Intellectual History Society, senior editor of Black Perspectives, co-editor of a book titled Invisible No More, The African American Experience at the University of South Carolina. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Professor Robert Green II, can you talk about what happened at Claflin? The students and others who you hear got these text messages and the response. Claflin is what, the oldest historically black university in South Carolina?
Yes, that is correct. And first off, thank you so much for having me on this morning. I can tell you that I heard from both students about the text messages and also from our campus security force, who sent out an email explaining to folks what the text messages were, to remain calm, but to also remain aware and alert of what was going on. Initially, when I heard about the text, I thought it was a bit of a hoax, but I soon began hearing from both students and campus security about it, and it quickly became clear that this wasn't just a Claflin problem, it was a national issue as well.
And what were the response of students, for example, who got these text messages? I mean, we hear the young woman who said, I mean, she sees the phone number that it's coming from and she texts back immediately because she was scared.
Well, certainly, I think for many of our students, it was a bit of a surprise to receive those text messages. On the other hand, our generation of students have grown up receiving a lot of text messages from a lot of unknown phone numbers. I think what makes us a bit different was the content of the messages themselves. For many students, they were surprised, they were a bit hurt, and coupled with the actual Election Day results, it has been a pretty frustrating week for many of our students. Mm.
Let me ask you, Wisdom Cole, you deal with young people around the country. Talk about what the NAACP has heard. How extensive is this?
You know, these messages are deeply disturbing, right? You know, as you said earlier, children as young as 13 have received these messages across the nation, I believe across 32 states. You know, this is a disturbing message to receive shortly after the election, right? But the sad part about it is that this is only the beginning. You know, when we see what's happening in this newly elected administration, we've seen this before, right? You know, the stripping away of diversity, equity, inclusion, the stripping away of our rights, right? You know, messages like this continue to set a precedent in terms of racism in America, in our schools, and in our phones. It's important for us to be able to protect our young people and allow them to understand that they deserve to be in those spaces, that they are a part of our community and our culture, and they're a part of what allows us to propel our future.
Now, what is the NAACP demanding, Wisdom Cole? I was interested that when the Trump campaign was asked to respond, this came out right after Trump was elected, they responded, this has nothing to do with us. They didn't go on to say, and we consider this vile and racist and it must stop. What exactly are you demanding? What do you understand from the company that was the platform for this? Was it called TextNow?
You know, regardless if you believe it has nothing to do with you, it impacts the future of our country. The real question is, what are you going to do about it? How are you going to ensure that everybody in this nation feels safe, that people feel like they can talk about their community, can talk about their culture, can be embraced, that they do not have the sense of fear? Many organizers across this nation have been working tirelessly over the last election season to ensure that we get this right. You know, it's important for us to recognize that moving forward, that there are a lot of things that are particular to our community that is going to be at stake, right? We are seeing an increase, and we've seen this before, right? An increase of racial hate in this country. And so with messages like this, we have to say enough is enough. We have to say that hate has no place here and that we have to ensure that there are protections for us at the local, state, and federal level.
Professor Robert Green II, I'm interested that you're at Claflin. Both Claflin and South Carolina State are in Orangeburg, South Carolina. A very violent history against African Americans. 1968, the Orangeburg Massacre, one of the most violent, least remembered events of the civil rights movement. February 8th, 68, crowd of students protesting at South Carolina State University, Orangeburg's only bowling alley, which was segregated. After days of escalating tensions, students started a bonfire, held a vigil. Dozens of police arrived, fired live ammunition into the crowd. Three students were killed, 28 wounded. If you can talk about that history and how people are organizing right now around these messages and the involvement now of various federal agencies investigating.
Well, certainly whenever something like this happens to students in Orangeburg, there's always a sense of thinking about what the Orangeburg Massacre means to us in 2024. Both universities have even longer histories of confronting racism than that. Certainly have the Orangeburg movement of the 1950s and 60s, which leads up to the Orangeburg Massacre of 1968. Decades before that, you have buildings on both campuses being burned down under so-called mysterious circumstances. And so for students at Claflin and SC State, the one thing they can take solace in is that they can tap into a long history of activism, protest, and resistance against oppression and tyranny. Many of those veterans of the civil rights movement, such as, for example, photographer Cecil Williams, still live in the Orangeburg area even now and offer their help and support to these students in a time like this one. As for right now, I think students are organizing not just against the text messages, but they're organizing themselves for a long struggle against the upcoming second Trump administration. But for them, the text messages are in many ways another galvanizing call to resistance and thinking about new and creative ways to resist what they perceive to be a very troubling Trump administration.
And finally, Wisdom Cole in Washington, D.C., plans are already underway for mass protests on January 18th, 2 days before the Trump inauguration. How is the NAACP dealing at this point?
You know, at this point, it's really important for us to take the time to dream of a better America, for us to be able to restore ourselves and understand about creative ways in which we can take on the most challenging problems that are going to face us in this new administration. I urge all of my organizers to be ready to defend, right? There are so many rights that we must protect in this nation. We have to organize, we have to build, so that one day we can win on all levels. It's important for us in this moment in time to understand the power that is within the people, and that for us to be able to come together to organize and understand this problem is absolutely necessary. Because as we see our rights be stripped away, we're going to slowly realize that we are more common than we know.
Wisdom Cole, I want to thank you for being with us, Senior National Director of Advocacy for the NAACP, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. And Robert Green II, History Professor at Claflin University, the oldest black university in South Carolina, President of the African American Intellectual History Society, Editor of Black Perspectives, Co-Editor of Invisible No More, The African American Experience at the University of South Carolina, speaking to us from that state. Next, more than 2,000 people packed the historic Riverside Church here in New York City to discuss America and the War on Palestine, moderated by author Ta-Nehisi Coates. Stay with us.
After tonight, if you don't want this to be a secret out of the past, I will resurrect it. I'll have a good go at it. I'll streak his blood across my beard, dust my feathers with his hair, feel his ghost breathing down.
Farewell Transmission by Ahaya. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. On Sunday, here in New York City, more than 2,000 people packed the historic Riverside Church for a discussion about America and the war on Palestine. It was hosted by the Palestine Festival of Literature, or PALFEST, the church, Riverside, where Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Gave his speech on April 4th, 1967, a year to the day before he was assassinated. The event yesterday featured several speakers, including Palestinian human rights attorney Nora Erekat, a professor at Rutgers University, author of Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine. Another of the panelists was Kianga Yamata Taylor, professor of African American Studies at Princeton University and contributing writer at The New Yorker magazine. You can see our interview with Professor Yamata Taylor last week at democracynow.org. In a minute, we'll hear from human rights attorney Nora Erekat. She was introduced by the moderator and author Ta-Nehisi Coates. His new book, The Message, in part about a visit he took to the occupied West Bank and Israel that was organized by members of PALFEST, the sponsors of yesterday's event. This is what he had to say.
When I think about being here, I think about ancestors. And I think it would be wrong if we didn't proceed without acknowledging that. First of all, I was informed when I came here that this is where Edward Said's funeral was. And so it's incredibly appropriate to be here in this moment. The second thing is something that Yasmin and I talked about and have been talking about for a year, even when we did the other event before, was the fact that this was also the place where Martin Luther King stood up against the Vietnam War and was so courageous. And I want to acknowledge that in his time when he did that, a lot of people did not applaud. Mm-hmm. I want to acknowledge that there were many people who he thought of as his allies who left him. Yes. That's why I think it's very appropriate, right?
Absolutely.
Who urged him to be silent as bombs were being dropped on helpless people. And he did not do that. And so I think in that spirit, that's the spirit in which we proceed in our conversation.
Yes.
We're going to talk a lot about theory today. Not that theory is irrelevant, but I do think it is important for us to ground ourselves in the reality of what is going on right now. And Nora, if you would just take a moment for us and speak to the ongoing genocide, the pain, the life lost, frankly, the role that we as Americans play in that. If you would just take a moment for us just to ground us so that we are not forgetting, so that we are not, you know, all the way up there. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Ta-Nehisi. Thank you, Kianga, and to this audience again. Thank you for coming to find sanctuary collectively. I think that this was a concern that after more than a year of watching slaughter of babies, this is essentially and continues to be a war on children.
Yes.
In a besieged territory where 50% of the population is children. So even before a bomb is dropped, it is a war on children. That it's really easy to then pivot to the theoretical piece to make sense of it. We want to make sense of it at this stage, and what gets lost is what's happening. And so I appreciated full transparency. Ta-Nehisi asked me to do this just, you know, right before this event. So I thought that the proper way to do it was actually to read testimony from the ground, from a colleague, who in Gaza, who is recounting as of 6 a.m. this morning, one of his colleagues woke up to 32 members of his family who were killed in Jabalia. And Jabalia is in the north, which is now under now an even tighter siege and a campaign of extermination and ethnic cleansing. What he writes upon waking up at 6 a.m. and finding his family slaughtered is that, quote, "I live meters away from them. It is a matter of luck. I wish I died with them. Neither my heart or mind can tolerate this. My uncle, his wife, and three sons and grandsons and daughters all deleted." He also lost his brother earlier in the year. And as we've been paying attention in this moment, which is important to ground, we're on day 400 of genocide, but we're on day 36 of the siege of the north. And the siege of the north is a tightening of the siege that already existed, right? And it's a siege that even predates the beginning of this campaign, this genocidal campaign. It's a siege that's been in place since 2006 at the earliest, thinking about a land siege and a naval blockade. But 1993, if you go back to when Gaza is first circumscribed by barbed wire, as a way to prepare for peace. The irony is that the preparation for peace was a program to isolate and separate the Gaza Strip from the rest of the question of Palestine, and to call it the Palestinian state-led, and never to leave the West Bank to negotiation. But it was done in the language of peace, that this doublespeak continues. But now here we are, of this 36 days of this particular campaign, and we got the earliest indication of it on day 6 of this genocide, when there was an order to evacuate the north to below the Wadi Gaza line, right? The line which was the order, if you remember, when 1.1 million Palestinians, that's more than half the population besieged, was ordered to leave the north to below the Wadi Gaza line. But note that that removal was a death sentence. As the World Health Organization called it a death sentence, how do you remove the immobile? How do you force the sick to travel? And those that did take the risk and travel were targeted on the humanitarian lines that they were given, indicating to us on day 6 that there would be no safe quarter, that this was a campaign of genocide. And it's why Holocaust studies scholar Ross Segal, the very next day, published in Jewish Currents, this is a textbook case of genocide, right? And it's why 800 TWAIL scholars, Third World Approaches to International Law scholars, when people call me international law, you know, the constant question that I get is, how do you still believe in the law? And I'm like, I'm a TWAIL scholar. We never believed in it. We've been telling you it is a source and a site of oppression and colonial domination. My book tries to see that.
Yes.
And tries to demonstrate how, despite this colonial structure, we can use it for emancipatory purposes under which circumstances, right? Use it when it suits us. Abandon it when it doesn't. Create new law when we can. It is a tool. It is not the word of God. It is not holy. It is subject to change and to change by us. So those 812 scholars who know that said, raising the alarm, this is genocide. This was all within the first week. All within the first week. And now we're hearing something known as the General's Plan. The General's Plan, which is the formula for exterminating the North, that 400,000 people total Palestinians left in the North, 100,000 particularly in the area now marked for ethnic cleansing. The General's Plan is the brainchild of General Giora. What is his first name? Giora Eland, who proposes this plan. Giora Eland was also the architect of the Eland Plan in the early 2000s. Which competed with Ariel Sharon's plan for unilateral withdrawal and disengagement, which was the withdrawal of Israeli settlers and the withdrawal of military installations, but the maintenance of occupation of Gaza. That Eland plan in the early 2000s was to ethnically cleanse all of Gaza into the Sinai. Right? So what the idea that he's now, and by the way, Medda Masr, so thanks to, you know, our partners, Medda Masr, wrote beautifully and thoroughly about the Eland plan. But you have the 1993 circumscription of Gaza and preparation for peace. You have the Eland plan in the year 2000. You have the evacuation order on October 12th, which was called a death sentence. You have the calls that this is genocide since day seven. You have now the General's Plan. We have a year, over a year, of bearing witness to what, you know, my job and other people's job has been to illuminate what can't be seen, what's been obfuscated. They have illuminated it for us. At this point, it is not about us telling you what you have to read between the lines. It's literally about what they don't want to hear, not what is not being revealed. Because they are telling us, they have shown us, it is evident, they are defending it. They call it self-defense. And they call the completion of the Nakba as the right to complete. So it's less obfuscation, right? And now it becomes more about, it's a battle of narrative. Who do you want to listen to?
Noura Erekat, professor at Rutgers University, author of Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine. Speaking Sunday here in New York at the historic Riverside Church, at an event moderated by author Ta-Nehisi Coates, his new book, The Message. The event was hosted by the Palestine Festival of Literature. Also in that discussion, Kianga Yamato Taylor, Princeton University professor. To see our interview with her, go to democracynow.org. The next PALFEST event, Palestine Festival of Literature, will be held in London November 20th to mark the republication of Edward Said's book, The Question of Palestine, followed by events in Detroit, Philadelphia, and Minneapolis. When we come back, we'll speak with Dutch-Palestinian Middle East analyst Muin Rabbani about Gaza, about Qatar suspending mediation talks between Israel and Hamas for a Gaza ceasefire, about Saudi Arabia hosting world leaders for an Arab-Islamic summit, and about protests in Amsterdam, where he is. Stay with us.
Soul.
by Mint Royale featuring De La Soul's Pastanus. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. We continue to look at Gaza, where Israeli forces launched a deadly attack early Sunday morning on a residential area in Jabalia, where displaced Palestinians were attempting to shelter, killing at least 36 people, including over a dozen children. Dozens of the victims were reportedly members of the same family asleep when Israeli forces attacked their home. An eyewitness who lost several relatives described the horrific scene.
We were just sitting peacefully. These are innocent citizens who don't belong to any military organization or faction. The eldest man is 70 years old. The house of Abu Sab Alush, Ali Alush, was bombed over the residents' heads without warning, which led to the martyrdom of everyone inside, more than 30 martyrs. Those who were lucky enough to survive were thrown onto the trees, onto the neighbors, and the remains are still scattered under the rubble.
Palestinian journalist Mohammed Khreis was killed along with his wife after an Israeli airstrike on their tent in the Nuseirat refugee camp. At least three more Gazan journalists were also killed in the Israeli strikes over the weekend. The attacks happened as the people of Gaza marked over 400 days since Israel launched its latest war, and as northern Gaza remains under a brutal siege, with hospitals surrounded by Israeli forces who have issued forced evacuation orders. But doctors and medical staff have refused to leave their patients behind. Amidst Israel's relentless attacks, the Palestine Red Crescent Society helped evacuate some 20 patients from Al-Auda Hospital in Jabalia and transferred them to Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. BRCS reported at least one of the patients died as the ambulances were held up for hours at an Israeli checkpoint. Meanwhile, the UN-backed Famine Review Committee has joined other humanitarian groups in issuing a dire warning that there is a, quote, strong likelihood that famine is imminent in areas of northern Gaza. This all comes as Qatar suspended its efforts to mediate a Gaza ceasefire and hostage release deal until they say Israel and Hamas show, quote, willingness and seriousness to resume negotiations. Israel also carried out deadly strikes on Lebanon and Syria over the weekend, while the United States bombed Yemen over the past two nights. For more, we go to The Hague, where we're joined by Muin Rabbani, Dutch-Palestinian Middle East analyst, host of the Connections podcast. He's former senior analyst for the International Crisis Group and a contributor to the book Deluge, Gaza and Israel from Crisis to Catalysm. Muin, welcome back to Democracy Now! In a minute, we're going to ask you about the latest in Amsterdam, where police beat and arrested more than 100 pro-Palestinian protesters Sunday after they defied a ban on demonstrations following street clashes between visiting Israeli soccer fans and Dutch youth. But first, can you talk about the significance of Qatar temporarily withdrawing as a mediator between Israel and Hamas for the Gaza ceasefire talks, and about what's happening currently in Riyadh?
Yes, well, turning to Qatar first, several days ago, there were press reports that Qatar was going to, as you mentioned, suspend its mediation and also show the Hamas exile leadership that has been based in Qatar the door and ask them to leave the country in response to U.S. pressure. The expulsion of the Hamas leaders has been denied by Qatar, but it has indeed, as you mentioned, confirmed that it is suspending its mediation, saying basically that the parties aren't serious. And I think my own view is that this is something that Qatar and the other mediator, Egypt as well, should have done months ago when it became entirely apparent that there never were serious ceasefire negotiations and that this process was essentially serving as a fig leaf for Israel and for the United States to continue with their war of annihilation in the Gaza Strip and deflect criticism by claiming that they're involved in earnest initiatives to try to put an end to this war, as many of your listeners and viewers will know, every time there appears to be progress, the Israeli leader Benjamin Netanyahu shifts the goalposts and we're back to square one. And then Antony Blinken is trotted out to say that Hamas is the obstacle. So I think it's a good thing that these, at least that Qatar has suspended its efforts, and hopefully Egypt will do so soon as well, because this entire process has from the outset been a complete charade.
So talk about what's happening right now in Riyadh. Somewhat 60 world leaders, including the Syrian President Assad, including Erdogan and others, the Turkish president, are in Saudi Arabia right now. Talk about the significance of this, and then what this means in after the election of Donald Trump.
Well, this is the second such summit. The first was held, if I'm not mistaken, in late November or early December last year. It was supposed to be an emergency Arab League summit, but the Saudi de facto leader, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, then expanded it to also include the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. Many people felt that was an attempt to seek to dilute the decisions that would be reached by this enlarged conference. And indeed, the only relevant resolution that they adopted was that they would immediately begin providing humanitarian supplies to the Gaza Strip, irrespective of any Israeli restrictions. And in fact, they did absolutely nothing and delivered nothing unless they had Israeli approval to do so. This is now, if you will, a follow-up summit. It's possible that this one could be more serious because there is, as you know, a very significant risk now of an all-out war that would include Israel and Iran trading blows directly at each other. And I think Saudi Arabia and other Gulf Cooperation Council states are very much worried about being in the front line of any such conflict and being left with the consequences in terms of attacks on their own oil facilities and territory and so on. I mean, these are countries that had formerly looked to Israel as a reliable or potentially reliable security partner, but now see an Israeli government determined to set the entire region aflame, and they want to ensure that they're not consumed by those flames.
So where does Trump fit into this picture? Well known to be extremely close as his son, son-in-law, is also extremely close to the Saudi Arabian Prince Salman.
Yes. Well, as you mentioned, the relationship between the Saudi Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, and the American Crown Prince, Prince Jared of Kushner, is known to be very close. It's less clear what a second Trump administration will mean for the region. Will it be a continuation of Biden's policies towards the region, which were very much a continuation of the first Trump's administration's policies towards the region? Will Trump intensify, hard as that may be to believe, U.S. support for Israel and sign off on open warfare against Iran? Or will he also respond to those isolationist and anti-war elements among his constituency and seek to ensure that the U.S. is not drawn directly into an armed conflict in the Middle East, which would also mean using some leverage on Israel not to escalate matters further? The problem with Trump is that he is so erratic, and we still don't know who he's going to surround himself with, that it's very difficult to speculate about what the first months of a second Trump administration are going to bring. He's already, for example, indicated that Mike Pompeo and Nikki Haley, two well-known Middle East hawks, will not be part of his administration. But against that, he's also been closely working with Brian Hook, a well-known Iran hawk, and has indicated that his new ambassador to the United Nations will be Congresswoman Stefanik, who is also well-known for her very, very radical positions with respect to the region.
I wanted to ask you about where you are right now. You're at The Hague, Muin Rabbani, but I want to ask you about the latest news nearby in Amsterdam, where police beat and arrested more than 100 pro-Palestinian protesters on Sunday after they defied a ban on demonstrations following street clashes between visiting Israeli soccer fans, many of them violent, and Dutch youth. Unrest in the city began on Wednesday when fans of the Maccabi Tel Aviv football team were seen chanting such slogans, and I want to get those slogans right, but I'll be careful in what I say. Let the IDF win and F the Arabs, but of course they say F, referring to the Israeli army's offensive in Gaza. Another video captured a fan screaming, F you terrorists, Sinwar die. Everybody die, in reference to the Hamas leader who was assassinated last month. Amsterdam's mayor blamed, quote, anti-Semitic hit and run squads, but many observers in Amsterdam said the Israeli fans were responsible for instigating the violence, the Israeli soccer fans known as hooligans. The violence grew into an international story as Israel sent planes to evacuate the Israeli fans. On Sunday, the Israeli journalist Gideon Levy wrote a piece for the newspaper Haaretz in Israel, headlined, "The Amsterdam attack shows Israelis' denial of the reality they created." In it, Gideon Levy writes, quote, "Why do they hate us so much? No, it's not because we're Jews. Not that there isn't anti-Semitism. Of course there is, and it must be fought. But the attempt to pin everything on it is ridiculous and mendacious. The North African immigrants, the Arabs and the Dutch people who rioted, saw the horrors in Gaza over the past year. They're not willing to remain silent about them. This is another cost of the war in Gaza that should have been considered. The world will hate us for it. Every Israeli abroad will be a target for hatred and violence from now on. That's what happens when you kill almost 20,000 children, carry out ethnic cleansing, and destroy the Gaza Strip. It's a little quirk of the world. It doesn't like those who commit these sorts of crimes." Again, those are the words of the Israeli journalist Gideon Levy in a piece for Haaretz. Muin Rabbani, can you talk about what happened?
Yes. Well, just to pick up where you left off, in fact, their favorite slogans were "Death to the Arabs, may your village burn, and there is no school in Gaza because all the children are dead." But it wasn't just about racist and genocidal slogans. These Israeli soccer hooligans, thugs, if you will, also engaged in property destruction, assaulting people of Arab appearance, assaulting taxis, and totaling one of them. And more importantly, they were allowed to do all this under police protection. If you compare it to British football, for example, when British teams play abroad, the British government sends police details with them, not to protect the hooligans, but to restrain them and ensure that they're unable to do any damage. And so what we're talking about here in Amsterdam is not a clash between the hooligans of two opposing sides, but rather these Israeli thugs attacking people who, in principle, had nothing to do with the game, and then afterwards being confronted by their victims with some violence included. And then you had kind of a power struggle within the Dutch elites. Geert Wilders, the far right, effectively the ruler of the Netherlands, seeking to undermine the government and prime minister he appointed in order to increase his power over them, that government seeking to retain its fiefdom, if you will, his coalition partners seeking to maintain their power. So they all began kind of outbidding each other in demonizing their own citizens, in calling these clashes an anti-Semitic Jew hunt, which would only make sense if one could demonstrate that the victims of these clashes were not just supporters of the Israeli team or Israelis more generally, but also Dutch Jews and Dutch Jewish institutions and Dutch Jewish properties. And there's no evidence that such attacks took place, or even that the Dutch Jewish community, which of course would have been understandably fearful given all these reports they were receiving about Jew hunt and anti-Semitic pogrom and so on, there's no evidence that they even asked for police protection on the night in question. And so, you know, the government, Wilders, the mayor of Amsterdam, have all been going to increasing extremes of trying to compare what happened to the Nazi occupation, the German occupation of the Netherlands during the 1940s.
Let me play, Mouin, for you what the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu said. He's spoken with U.S. President-elect Donald Trump three times in the past few days, also commenting on what happened in Amsterdam on Thursday night.
Yesterday we marked the Kristallnacht that happened 86 years ago on European soil. It was a brutal and violent attack against Jews, just because they were Jews. Unfortunately, in the last few days, we saw pictures that recall that night. In the streets of Amsterdam, anti-Semitic rioters attacked Jews, Israeli citizens, just because they were Jews. But there is one big difference between that night and our time. Today, we have a state.
Your response to the Israeli Prime Minister Mouin Rabbani?
Well, the key difference, of course, between Kristallnacht in November 1938 and what we saw in Amsterdam on the 7th of November is that the properties that were marked for assault and attack were targeted because they were, for example, displaying Palestinian flags, not menorahs. So that's kind of a key difference. And, you know, all this talk about that these people were singled out because they were Jews rather than because they were football supporters or presumed to be supporters of this racist, genocidal gang of soccer hooligans is really just, you know, trying once again to make the point that the real victims here are not the children who are being slaughtered in the Gaza Strip. The real victims are those who are engaging in the slaughter and those who are perpetrating the genocide. And what has happened now is that the Dutch government, municipality of Amsterdam, the Amsterdam police have put in emergency measures banning all demonstrations in opposition to the genocide. And as you mentioned, have now started arresting dozens of people who have violated that ban to assemble peacefully to protest what is happening in Gaza. There's a larger background here, of course, which is the failure, the refusal of the international soccer authorities known as FIFA and UEFA to take any measures against Israel, the Israeli Football Association, Israeli football clubs, in sharp contrast to their immediate imposition of comprehensive measures against the Russian Federation and Russian teams literally within days of the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
We only have 30 seconds, but can you finally comment on what's happening in Lebanon? The thousands of people killed, the attacks continuing, particularly in southern Lebanon, despite Israel claiming ceasefire talks are progressing.
Yes, well, Israel is failing militarily. It's still stuck on the border zone and is therefore taking out its anger, its aggression on the Lebanese civilian population and hoping to use that as a form of pressure on the government and on Hezbollah to achieve something.
I want to thank you so much, Mouin, for joining us. Mouin Rabbani, Dutch-Palestinian Middle East analyst, host of the Connections podcast, former senior analyst for the International Crisis Group, contributor to the book Deluge, Gaza and Israel from Crisis to Cataclysm. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for our video news production and digital fellowships. Go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!
Keep smiling, keep shining. If you want to support 93.3 CFMU and independent businesses, there's one sure way to do it. Get your hands on a Friends of CFMU card. For a donation of only $30, you get a card that gives you discounts at businesses all throughout the greater Hamilton area. Make sure you check out cfmu.ca and go down to the footer for more information. Use your card at Arcade, Amigos, Big B Comics, Downtown Bike Hounds, or Dr. Disc.